Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast. I'm joined this week by Michael Lee from Fordham University. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
Michael is here to talk a little bit about March marks the anniversary of the assassination of Oscar Romero in El Salvador. And Michael is a professor that teaches liberation theology at Fordham, is also affiliated with the Institute for Latin American Studies. So we thought we could kind of take a look at Bishop Romero's life and also where things stand for his cause for canonization. Michael, I thought we'd start just for our listeners, probably pretty familiar with Bishop Romero, but maybe you could just give us a quick thumbnail sketch of his life for us.
Okay, well, Archbishop Oscar Romero is a Salvadoran, and for much of his life, he would have been kind of an unremarkable figure in history. He was ordained in 1941 and served all of his ministry in El Salvador, rising through the ranks of priesthood, a bishop, and then it is in 1977 that he's appointed Archbishop of El Salvador, and here he really enters into history, and his story really becomes known, because at the time, he was viewed as a docile, conservative candidate who was approved by the oligarchy and conservative elements in El Salvador as a safe bet as archbishop. And those who were on the progressive left were terrified at his appointment. And yet, very shortly in that time, he made a change. Some would even call it a conversion. And eventually he would be really the outspoken voice of justice in defense of the poor and those who were fighting for their rights. And so his ministry as archbishop, which lasted 3 years until that fateful day in March of 1980, when he was assassinated while saying Mass, mark a remarkable tenure as archbishop and, of course, mean his fame and his legacy.
Now, what moment do people point to as kind of the moment where, whether you want to call it his conversion or whatever, when did that happen?
Well, in that month before he was ordained archbishop, there was the first of what would be, sadly, a string of assassinations of priests. And it was a Jesuit priest by the name of Rutilio Grande who was killed just outside the town of Aguilares. And most people point to this moment, seeing Rutilio Grande, and in fact, an old man and a young boy were killed with him. And in front of those bodies and thinking through the implications of soldiers killing priests, Romero is suddenly transformed. And while that certainly is a most powerful event that can't be overestimated, to contract, to shrink his conversion moment to that one moment is a bit too dramatic, I think. I think if you look at his biography, you'll see that 3 years prior, Romero was appointed bishop of an area called Santiago de Maria, and there he really came into contact with intense rural poverty, with the stories of campesinos who endured unbelievable hardships and repression, kidnappings, tortures, etc. And so you see in those prior years this opening of Romero, so you can really talk about a conversion process rather than just this one stark moment.
Now, did he have much contact with the theologians who were working down there, people like John Sobrino?
It's interesting. He gives a homily in 1975 that criticizes so-called new Christologies. And, of course, that year, Sobrino had published his Christology. So in those early years of the 1970s, he was quite critical of liberation theology, of new theologies. But pretty soon, after becoming archbishop, it's precisely those people that he criticized that he began to listen to collaborate with. And for instance, Sobrino would be a close collaborator of his, helping him write some of his pastoral letters and famous speeches. And so that marks another dimension of the so-called change or conversion in Romero.
So we're talking about really only a three-year period. He would became archbishop in 1977, was assassinated in 1980.
That's right.
That's correct. And during that time, what was the, did he do a lot of writing, speaking? What do people point to as kind of the body of his work?
Well, the two important events in 1977 are that after the assassination of Rutilio Grande, he makes Grande's funeral mass the only mass celebrated in the whole country that weekend. And so this was a bold statement about the importance of Grande, his ministry in forming base communities, etc., and a real public statement about the position of the church. That, along with the decision to boycott the inauguration of the fraudulently elected general Humberto Romero. The Archbishop had always attended inaugurations and, in a sense, in a symbolic sense, had blessed these. So for Romero to come out and say that he's boycotting the inauguration of the president was another bold step. Now, the rest of his tenure then is marked by writings and homilies. In fact, the homilies are listened to on the radio throughout the whole country. I mean, there are stories of people who say that they could walk down the street and listen to the entire homily just by each car or window that they'd pass by. Everyone in the country was listening to what Romero had to say, because he not only made theological, doctrinal exposition a part of his homily, but he would conclude homilies with the news, the events of the country. And so he would read the names of those who were disappeared. He would cite massacres, etc., things that weren't being made available to the public, things that the press were not reporting, were being made known through his homily. So very often you'll hear the nickname, the voice of the voiceless, and in a large way, it was through his homilies and writings that Romero did this. In addition to that, he dedicated the work of the Archdiocese to the defense of human rights. He took a lawyer's organization and asked them to work under the auspices of the Archdiocese, Socorro Judicial, which pressed human rights abuse cases and so on. So his work certainly took on a profound political nature, yet at the same time it was the work of the Archbishop. I mean, if you read his diary, his days really were filled with the celebration of sacraments, confirmations, meetings with priests. So it's important not to overlook that basis of his ministry as well.
And then the date of his assassination is March 24th, 1980. What were the circumstances of that event?
By that time, you had had seven priests assassinated in the archdiocese. You had numerous catechists and other church workers disappeared. And you had the threats against Romero's own life through telephone calls, notes, etc. You had these threats multiplying. So by 1980, you had really intense pressure. At the same time, you had an increased rhetoric from Romero himself, culminating in this very famous, his last cathedral homily, in which he makes an appeal to the military, to the soldiers themselves, and tells them that the law of God is higher than the law of human beings, and so they should disobey the order to kill fellow Salvadorans. And this was unbelievably received, loud ovations in the cathedral, and it really reverberated throughout the country, and many would say this sealed his fate, because it was the next day in the small chapel of the hospital where he lived, while saying Mass, that he was shot in the heart.
So after his death, how did his cause for canonization proceed?
Well, many in the country, of course, embraced him and thought of him immediately as not only a martyr, but a saint as well. And so just in terms of a popular reception, the numerous pictures of Romero's and Campesino houses, the number of people who acclaimed him for his word and his action, that was throughout the country, and that's an undeniable part. It still is to this day of Romero's legacy. At official levels, of course, and Ken Woodward in his book, Making Saints, really documents this well, there was a lot of reservation. Recall that it's after Romero's assassination in 1980 that the FMLN organizes as a guerrilla organization, and you have really the commencement of the Salvadoran Civil War. So in the mid-1980s, the country itself is at civil war, and church officials were concerned that the canonization of Romero, someone who was championed by the left, would mean somehow a covert or a symbolic blessing of that cause. And this is something that they wanted to avoid. So during the civil war of the 1980s, it looked unlikely that the cause of Romero would be touched. Time moving on, though, it seemed like his cause was never taken up, that in fact Romero's legacy was one that made certain officials uncomfortable and continues to make certain figures in the church in Latin America, in the hierarchy in Rome, uncomfortable. And so even to this day, you have reticence on the part of many to see Romero canonized.
So we're now 27 years after his assassination. Where do things stand right now?
Well, recently there was an AP story that the cause of Romero is delayed, especially over the question of whether he was truly a martyr for the faith or whether he was killed for other reasons. And another part of it really concerns this question of his conversion. There are those who would resist the notion that an archbishop of the church experiences a conversion. These questions, of course, need to be resolved. Now, at the same time, both John Paul II and Benedict have come out and said that, in fact, Romero is one who has died for the faith. So it's unclear to me why that objection would still stand. And I think there's still work, investigation going on. But at the end of the day, I think it would be just and correct for his canonization to go through.
But you're right. In the past, too, it has other causes have been complicated by the political element. Somebody who was just declared a saint, Franz Jägerstätter, for example, and that was delayed for a long time because here was an individual who was a conscientious objector, refused to be drafted into Hitler's army, and was killed. And there was some question whether it was because of his political resistance or was this an act? Was he a martyr? In fact, so. This isn't the first case where this has happened.
That's right. And I think another thing that would help would be a more precise look at the situation in El Salvador at the time. Terms like liberation theology. Well, actually, there were several liberation theologies and several approaches. And Romero was always very cautious. And if one reads, for instance, his third pastoral letter, he makes careful distinctions about the role of the church and the role of Christians in political movements for liberation, etc. It's wrong to identify Romero as one who blurred the line incorrectly between faith and politics. If anything else, I think he is a living embodiment of the kind of integral salvation that was talked about in magisterial documents from Medellin and Puebla to those of John Paul II.
Now, you referred earlier to this question of conversion and whether Archbishop Romero, in fact, experienced a conversion. You've written about this. You shared a paper that you're working on with me. And the question is, should we call it evolution or should we call it conversion? Maybe you can talk about that.
Yeah, I think it's an important debate. There are those, in fact, taking a quote of Romero's in a conversation that he had with Cardinal Baggio, who was concerned about this language of the Archbishop experiencing a conversion. Romero denies this and talks about his change as an evolution. On the other hand, there are those who see this profound change that occurs in the manner of Romero's ministry and want to say, yes, this is in fact a conversion. I think if you take a look at Romero's own preaching and writing on the concept, it's really a both-and situation. Really, the discussion about Romero's evolution or conversion operates at two levels. One is at the level of the character of his conversion. That is it this immediate thing that on one day he was one man, on the next day he was different, or was it more of a process? Here, as I suggested earlier, I think it definitely is a process that's intensified in these few years just prior to the assassination of Rutilio Grande that can be seen as its culmination. On the other hand, there's the question of the content of Romero's conversion. And I think here, sometimes the language of evolution, the temptation might be that it minimizes, that it sanitizes Romero's change. And I think those who advocate for the use of the term conversion really want to point to a real change in approach, one that I think is well summarized in that phrase, the preferential option for the poor. So the degree to which you want to protect the real character of that change and his real preferential option for the poor of his country, I think the language of conversion is appropriate. so that if one uses this language of conversion and sees it in a way that is has a long history in the Christian tradition, that is, you can invoke images of a pilgrimage, journey, etc., you can incorporate the insights of this evolution language. At the same time, you're preserving, you could say, the sting of Romero's legacy.
Now, Archbishop Romero is somebody who is still beloved in this country and internationally, not just in El Salvador. And this is 27 years after his death. Why do you think that is?
Well, at the root of the term martyr, of course, is a Greek term meaning to witness, to testify. And Romero's life and his writings are a really powerful witness, a testimony to a life that was engaged, a faith that was engaged with history, with the world, and yet sought to shine the light of the gospel on that situation. And I think Romero is a compelling figure, not just in El Salvador, but throughout the world for that reason. Contemporary people are struggling with the question of how do I think about faith in the contemporary world? How do I engage the important issues of our time from the perspective of faith? And he provides a witness, an example, a model for that. And I think ultimately that's what the church has saints for. They are models. They are people that we revere and look at as models and examples of the pressing questions of our time. In many ways, if you travel around El Salvador and talk to people in communities, he is a saint already. He's been received by the community that way. But I think this process in terms of the universal church is an important one, precisely because as people are talking about globalization, about the shrinking of our world, I think his legacy crosses borders, and Christians in the United States, in Europe, in Asia, in Africa have as much to learn about this remarkable man as the Salvadoran does.
Well, Michael Lee, thank you very much. This is very helpful, and perhaps when there's more news to report on the cause of Oscar Romero, you can come back in.
I'd be very glad to.
Okay, thanks very much.
I want to thank you again for joining us for this week's edition of the America Magazine podcast. Just want to make one small correction. During our discussion with Michael Lee, I mentioned that Franz Jägerstätter had been declared a saint. He's actually been beatified, which is the step before sainthood. Finally, you'd like to know that you can respond to our podcasts and comment on them at our Podbean site, and we received a couple of notes about our interview with Father Roger Haight, which was last week's episode. So I'm going to read one from David Jackson. Mr. Jackson said he found the podcast to enhance the article, but he was a bit disappointed in the lack of dialogue in the podcast on the tension between the Vatican's stress on orthodoxy and, quote-unquote, the dangers of relativism. The Vatican response to many of the theologians cited in the article has been very negative, and Father Roger Haight has himself come under suspicion and a bit of silencing. Congratulations to America for publishing this article and podcast. Well, we thank Mr. Jackson, and we hope that you'll respond at americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.